Victoria Ackroyd, talking about nutrient management in mid-Atlantic organic grain cropping systems.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Wonderful to see a semi-full house. I am Victoria Ackroyd, and today I'm going to be talking about some work that Drs. Stephen Mirsky, Michelle Cavagelli, and John Spargo did, as we just said, looking at nutrient management in the mid-Atlantic. So organic systems have rather a unique challenge in that they can't use conventional fertilizers. Rather, they have to derive their nutrients from usually at least one of two sources. One obvious source is legume cover crops, legumes, of course, primarily providing nitrogen. And when you're talking about legumes, you're, of course, talking about things like alfalfa and hairy vetch. However, legumes do have a downside. There's a cost for the seed. There's a time cost for planting and managing. And then, of course, legumes are living things, so you have this issue where biomass, you know, production may be variable across years. And thus, in turn, you may not reliably get as much nitrogen as you might hope for a following cash crop. Even if you do get sufficient nitrogen, there's no guarantee that that nitrogen will be released in perfect time for a cash crop to make use of it. On the other hand, you can also use organic amendments such as manure, other animal byproducts like feather meal. Unlike legume cover crops, there's a lot more phosphorus compared to the nitrogen in these organic amendments. You're looking at plant available nitrogen to phosphorus ratios of from 1 to 2 to about 2 to 1, generally speaking. This, of course, raises very serious environmental concerns because you get pea buildup in the soil and then runoff. As with the cover crops, again, you have cost and access issues, and again, you have this issue where you can have variable nitrogen content and release characteristics. Now, the one source that we don't typically think of, because sometimes it's hard to quantify, is the soil itself. In systems with a long history of cover cropping and organic amendment additions, the soil can be a considerable reservoir of plant nutrients. So we have this goal of, on the one hand, maintaining or sustaining crop yield, and on the other hand, not having excessive phosphorus buildup that negatively impacts our Chesapeake Bay region in our case. And so we decided to use a multi-tactic, multifunctional approach where we wanted to see if we could combine legume cover crops with organic amendments. And with those organic amendments, we wanted to see, can we knock the application rate down from a rate that supplies sufficient nitrogen for the cash crop just to the pea removal rate, and then use soil reserves as a buffer in cases where maybe the legume cover crop doesn't perform as well as we might have hoped. So this does bear reiterating. You can say, why even ask this question? And we asked this question because we have evidence in our area that there is sufficient soil reserves of these nutrients. So in a conventional no-till system where there was not a history of manure application and where there was very minimal cover crop use, you can see the yield here. And you can see that in the organic system, which did previously have extensive cover crop and manure use, the yield was much higher. So emphasizing this notion that a three-pronged attack might, you know, help with multiple issues and still meet farmer needs in terms of yield. So we had four experiment sites for this study. The first one was at Beltsville Agricultural Research Center, a long history of cover crop and manure use. Unfortunately, the soil in this field was extremely stony. It was a rather difficult site. And the typical rotation here involves corn, soybeans, and wheat. Now, on the eastern shore of Maryland, we had Cut Fresh Organics, which is a cooperating farmer, again, a long history of poultry litter use. This rotation involving soybeans, corn, small greens, and vegetables. Moving on to Fairhill Farms, another cooperating farmer. Again, long history of poultry litter use. This site is unique in that, in addition to corn, soybeans, and wheat, this site had a rotation that included 3 years of alfalfa. And then finally, Mason Heritage Farm, our last cooperating farmer site. Worth noting, this was our only irrigated site. And unlike the other sites, there was only kind of an intermediate history of cover crop and manure use. And again, mostly we're dealing with corn, rye, soybeans, and a mixture of crimson clover and small grain for our rotation. So we had 2 years per site and four replications at each site. And you can see our plot size up here. It was a split plot design. So our main factor was cover crops, and I'm going to go on ahead and talk about that in a minute. We also had poultry litter application, where we had poultry litter that we broadcast and then incorporated within 24 hours, and we either applied it at a rate sufficient to, you know, provide enough nitrogen for the cash crop, or else we applied it at the phosphorus removal rate, and then finally our control was plots where we didn't apply any poultry litter. I say split plot because technically this was a situation where we had weedy and weed-free plots. Today, however, I'm just going to talk about the weed-free plot data. So at three of our sites, we had some combination of these three cover crops. At Bark, we had all three. So we had crimson clover, hairy vetch, or Austrian winter pea planted at the rates that you can see on the screen. And our control was just left to winter weeds. Now at Fair Hill, we had alfalfa, and we treated the alfalfa three ways. We removed the first cutting for one treatment, so we took that biomass out of the field. For another treatment, we plowed the first cutting under, so the biomass was left in the field. And then we also, in one treatment, terminated the alfalfa in the summer and planted cereal rye in the fall. So this, of course, raises the question, how did our cover crops do? And here is how our cover crops did. First off, I'd like to key you into how these graphs are set up. So we have on our y-axis dry above ground biomass in kilograms per hectare, excuse me. On the x-axis, we have our cover crop treatments. And then I'd also like to point out the color coding. So yellow always means weeds. Our no cover treatment, of course, was left to winter weeds, so that's just weeds. And then, for instance, here in the winter pea treatment, you can see it was about half winter pea biomass and about half weed biomass. It was a rather weedy year in Beltsville at this site. Now, when you don't see yellow on this graph, so this is not because, oops, we lost our bags. It's because there wasn't sufficient weed biomass in that site year to collect or to separate out. So this gives you a rough idea for these two sites of how much biomass was produced, ranging from about 2,000 kilograms per hectare in the no cover in 2011 up to a total of about 7,000 kilograms per hectare when you count crimson clover plus its weeds. The other thing that's worth noting here is that we would normally expect this purple bar to be much larger. I don't want you guys to walk away with the misimpression that crimson clover routinely produces more biomass than hairy vetch in the mid-Atlantic. That's not true. It's just in this particular case, this is what we saw. In 2012, we saw somewhat higher biomass production levels in Beltsville, and no weeds there to speak of. Moving down to cut fresh, again, 2011 was a fairly weed-free year, and at cut fresh, we just had winter pea and hairy vetch. Roughly the same amount of biomass. Again, winter pea is usually not going to produce, you know, nearly as much biomass as hairy vetch. In that case, though, you look at the standard errors, and they're pretty close. They're pushing 4,000 kilograms per hectare. But then skipping over to 2012 at the same site, as with Beltsville, you see slightly higher biomass production. And you also see there were weeds that second year. Moving on to our other two sites, it's going to keep doing that, apologies. At Fair Hill, alfalfa produced less biomass than the rye both years. And as we've previously seen, 2011, there was less biomass in general than in 2012, ranging at Fair Hill from about 4,000 kilograms per hectare for the alfalfa in 2011, up to a high of just under 8,000 kilograms per hectare in the cereal rye treatment in 2012. So that gives us our range. And then moving down to our final site, which was Mason, we saw weeds both years, considerable weeds both years, and we saw, you know, a range of about 2,500 up to almost 8,000 kilograms per hectare of biomass total in 2011. A bit more in 2012, yeah. And then the orange. You can see the orange, and you can promptly forget the orange. This was a case where the crimson clover biomass production was so low that the farmer actually overseeded triticale that year just because he was not happy with that field. So moving on to corn grain yield, which is, of course, most farmers' primary concerns. Again, cluing you in a bit to the graphs, we've got corn grain yield in kilograms per hectare on our y-axis. We have the cover crop treatments on our x-axis, and in this case, we also have our poultry litter treatment on the x-axis. So not only do we have the color coding, but we're going to introduce another form of coding here in that the no poultry litter treatment is always a solid bar. That's a zero for poultry litter. The pea removal rate poultry litter is always the diagonals going from left to right. And then the nitrogen-based rate for the poultry litter application is always diagonals going right down to left. So if you go up here to my p-value, you can see that there was no interaction between cover crop and poultry litter. So I'm showing you the main effects separately. And oh dear, there were no effects whatsoever that we detected in this field in 2011 in Beltsville. How odd. The nearest that we can come up with is that this field had such a long history of cover crop and manure use that basically there was such a huge soil reservoir that we didn't see any effects because basically that reservoir masked any effects that there might be there to see. Corn grain yield was, you know, pretty decent in this year. If you were to see this graph for 2012, you would see that yields were pretty low compared to this. However, the pattern was the same, so I'm not going to present the 2012 data. Moving on to cut fresh, we go up here and we see that there was an interaction between cover crop and poultry litter. This is the only site that we saw this at, and so I'm showing the combined effects here. Again, solid bar means zero poultry litter applied, and then the yellow means this was the weedy, no cover crop treatment. And in 2011, you can see that basically the major difference here is that in the treatment where we did nothing, there was no poultry litter applied and there was no cover crop, corn produced less grain than in the other treatments. This is an effect that followed through to 2012. And so what this is suggesting is twofold. First off, you have to do something. The soil reservoir here was not sufficient to support corn grain yield. However, when you compare the phosphorus and the nitrogen poultry litter rates, you see that, you know, you can safely knock down the rate and still get decent yields, statistically speaking, which is good to see. Moving on to Fair Hill, I'm separating out the main effects because, again, there was no interaction between cover crop and poultry litter. And we're confused about 2011. All I'll say about 2011 is that statistics are ongoing. It does not make sense that there was less corn grain yield in the alfalfa left in the field treatment than in the alfalfa and rye treatment, because rye traditionally you think of as immobilizing soil nitrogen. You would expect that yield would be worse, which is what we saw in 2012. Moving on to the poultry litter main effect, we see, you know, another confusing thing in 2011, the no poultry litter treatment yielded more grain than the other two treatments. Counterintuitive, these are preliminary statistical results, and in 2012 we didn't see any significant differences. So moving on to our final site, this is looking a lot like Beltsville, again suggesting sufficient reservoir of nutrients in the soil to basically mask any differences we might see. No cover versus winter pea versus crimson clover for both years. And then moving on to the main effect of poultry litter at this site, this is what we would expect to see. This suggests that at Mason, it was good that we applied something. However, we didn't need to apply the nitrogen rate. We were perfectly fine with the phosphorus removal rate. And in 2012, we did not see any differences in grain yield. So what conclusions can we come to? At sites with a long history of cover crop and manure application, there's considerable soil reserves of nutrients that may exist. At these sites, it's fairly safe to say that you can apply manure at the phosphorus removal rate rather than at an N-based rate. And ongoing work has involved trying to optimize the use of cover crops and manure together to see basically how long we can coast on those soil reserves for. So with that, I would like to acknowledge our colleagues, and I would also like to thank the funding agency which provided money for us to do this work, which was USDA NIFA OREI. And with that, do we have time for questions?
We don't have time for questions, unfortunately.
A lot. Thank you.
Thank you.